Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland, and today I thought I would address some listener mail. I haven't done that in a while. And by address, I mean read it and answer it, as opposed to sending out an address. You know what I meant. At any rate, we're going to be looking at several questions and comments, including a correction. And also, a little bit later, I'm going to bring in a special mystery guest to talk about one of the specific pieces that were sent in to me. So let's get started. The first message says, "Hello, longtime listener, first time emailer. I wanted to slip in a quick correction in regards to the aircraft carriers episode. In the episode, you said that the U.S. aircraft carrier, the Hornet, was sunk. It's actually not. It's anchored in Oakland, California, across the bay from San Francisco, and is open as a museum to teach visitors about how aircraft carriers work. The flight deck, maintenance deck, and some lower decks are open to explore with or without a tour. The island and engine room are open for tours. There is even an Apollo capsule on board, as the Hornet was the recovery ship for two Apollo missions. If you're ever in or around Oakland, check it out. Regards, Alan." Alan, thanks for sending in that correction. That's really awesome. The Hornet was one of the stories that I thought was particularly cool. It was an honest mistake on my part. I had so many notes about so many different aircraft carriers, and I should have been more careful making sure that all of those were accurate. And Scott, is not his fault at all. It's all on me. I shall admonish myself repeatedly. Next, Dan from Twitter asked, "Did I buy an Apple Watch?" No. Okay, well, we're ready to move on. I guess I can address this a little further. I did not buy an Apple Watch. I don't have an iPhone, so an Apple Watch would be useless to me. And I don't want to invest in an iPhone just to get an Apple Watch. That would end up being an incredibly expensive endeavor. I mean, you're talking around $380 for the watch, and that's, you know, before you really start looking at really nice bands or anything like that. then you've got another couple hundred bucks for the iPhone plus the monthly fee for it and everything. And all of my stuff is currently in the Android operating system universe. I use a Nexus 6 as my smartphone. That's not a plug for Android. It's not a plug for the Nexus line of phones. I like it, and I'm used to it, and all of my stuff is in that ecosystem. So it'd be very arduous to switch to a different one at this point. I think the Apple Watch is an interesting product. I'm curious how well it will do in the long run. As I record this, there are plenty of stories about the Apple Watch getting some recalls because of a faulty vibrating motor that's in some of them, and that the production may have slowed down quite a bit, which means it's going to take even longer for people to get their pre-ordered watches. It's a bit of an issue for Apple. And honestly, the wearables field is still one of those where a lot of people are expressing a lot of skepticism about, you know, what's actually the utility of a smartwatch? Is there a need for it? I own a Pebble, which I would say is a smart-ish watch. It is good for giving me notifications that are coming through my phone, which is actually really useful for me. I don't always notice when my phone vibrates in my pocket. Even though the Nexus 6 is as large as some countries, I don't always notice when it's vibrating. However, the motor that's inside my watch, when it vibrates on my wrist, I absolutely notice that. And it gives me the notifications of who is calling or if I've received a text message or some other notification. And I love that. That, to me, is perfect. And, you know, it's not super high tech as far as smartwatches go. It's not like there's a whole bunch of other usefulness with it apart from some of the cool apps you can have, and you can do some controls with your smartphone, like advancing through tracks and an audio list, that kind of thing. That stuff is interesting and neat, but it doesn't have a whole lot of utility beyond that. The Apple Watch obviously is supposed to be more robust, and I hope it does well, because I want to see this kind of technology, this whole branch of technology, continue and advance and evolve. And my worry is that if the Apple Watch ultimately does not do well, because it's such a high-profile product, it could sink the entire branch of technology or set it back by a couple of years. It kind of reminds me of the days when virtual reality things were coming out and people were first getting a chance to actually use them, and they became disappointed, disenchanted with the technology that they thought was going to be amazing and turned out not to be as amazing as they had hoped. And it set the entire field back by at least 5 years because no one wanted to fund something that people no longer had any interest or faith in. So my hope is that the Apple Watch does well. I do not plan to get one again because I don't have an iPhone. I may end up picking up a different smartwatch. There were a few that I supported on various crowdsourcing campaigns. I'm still waiting on all three of the ones that I supported, one of which is not even a smartwatch. It's a just a cool concept watch. And so I don't think I'd be eager to jump on the smartwatch train, even if I did have an iPhone, simply because I've already spent money on watches that I don't have. And that's another discussion for another day. The entire idea of crowdsourcing, you know, crowdfunding a technology project. Is that a good idea? What are the dangers? I should probably do a full episode about that. I know I've talked about it once or twice in previous episodes, but we should probably go into an in-depth discussion about what should your expectations be if you participate in that sort of thing. So there's your long answer to your simple question. No, and because. All right, we'll move on to the next one. Luke on Twitter asks, how soon I expect we'll see stores like Kinko's get 3D printers for customers to use? I think that's actually going to be probably at least a couple of years further down the line. From the thing I think 3D printers are really going to be useful for is going to be on-demand fabrication for small businesses, meaning that instead of having a giant furniture store with an enormous warehouse like IKEA, where you've got, you know, tons of inventory, and you have no way of knowing how well one is going to sell versus other versions of the same sort of stuff. Like, how well is this one cabinet going to sell compared to this other cabinet? Both of which have Norwegian or Danish or Swedish or Swiss or some Scandinavian name that has far more umlauts than is remotely necessary. How well is that going to sell versus any other one? You have to keep enough in stock so that you meet whatever demand you expect there to be, but there's no way of knowing from one day to the next how popular an item is going to be, even if you put one on sale and one's not on sale. 3D printers, however, can let you get around that. You don't have to have a huge warehouse to store all of your inventory. You can have essentially a storage space for the raw material for your printer, and then you create the items on demand when you get an order. So if someone wants a particular cabinet, you print out the parts and then sell the kit to the customer. You don't have to keep 8 different types of cabinets in storage. You just keep the digital plans and you print them as needed. I think that's going to be a very popular business model once we get to a point where these printers that are ready for commercial use like that fall into the range that a small business can actually make that a workable business model. It's pretty expensive if you want a really high quality 3D printer, especially one that can produce on an industrial level, even a small industrial level. As for things like Kinko's, I think that's going to take more time. And I think there are going to be some barriers as well, because obviously if you are a business like Kinko's, you want to be able to have at least some control over what is getting sent to that 3D printer. If it's something that is illegal, for example, or the legality is questionable, for example, a 3D printed gun, that could be a concern, especially if there were any crime associated with that weapon down the line and it gets brought in that your establishment was the one that allowed it to be printed. There could be some legal complications that I bet a lot of the big companies don't want to get bogged down in. And it may be that eventually things work out where the accountability lies with other players and not the company that actually is housing the 3D printer, in which case, you know, it may be open season, no pun intended with the gun thing, to allow everyone to send whatever they want to the printer. And as long as they're paying the rate for however much plastic is going through the extruder, they're fine. So I think we'll see the fabrication on demand model first. Of course, 3D printers are already being used in research and development as well as in manufacturing for other reasons. But as far as customers getting access to 3D printers, I think it'll be fabrication on demand where the company will be the one responsible for sending the specific plan to the specific printer, and the customer only says, okay, I want this item, so they don't get to say exactly what gets printed. And then maybe a couple years later we'll see models where people can send their digital file to a printer directly without having to just choose from a catalog of files. In the meantime, you know, there'll be plenty of people who will just go out and buy their own 3D printer. Depending upon how much money they spend, the stuff they print may or may not look really great, or it may look kind of clunky. I've seen some 3D printers where the fidelity, the resolution is incredible, and you can feel the edges of each layer, but you can't really see them easily. And then I've seen other ones where it's very apparent, where each layer is kind of overhanging the next layer by, you know, a millimeter or whatever, and it's very noticeable. So we'll see. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I suspect not. All right, we'll go to the next question. Nathaniel from Twitter asked how trackpads register input. How does a trackpad know where your finger is? There are two main ways that trackpads are manufactured. There are resistive trackpads and capacitive trackpads or touchpads. And I know I've talked about this on the show before, but I'll go ahead and explain how these work, because I think it is interesting. So the resistive touchpads or trackpads are the easiest to understand. They're also not necessarily as resilient as capacitive, but we'll get there. So resistive touchpads use a couple of different films with kind of a electrodes. Well, one film will have an electrode on it. The next film, like a sandwich filling, that one would be somewhat resistive. And then you would have a bottom plate that would also have an electrode on it. So you've got electrodes separated by a resistive film. When you press down on the surface of the top layer, it presses that electrode closer to the other electrode on the bottom, and you end up creating essentially a circuit. There is a connection there. And if you think about the two films as sort of wires, right? Like you have a series of horizontal wires along one film and vertical wires along the other electrode, then you've got a grid. So imagine you've got this grid there. When you put pressure on the touchpad, it acts like it pushes these two wires together at some point on that grid. And by locating the area of connection along that grid, a computer knows, oh, there has been a touch registered at this point on the touchpad. So, you know, it's almost like a spider web, right? So you've got this grid of connections. And when you press down, it sends the signal. And by measuring that signal, the computer can tell where along the touchpad you are touching. Capacitive is a little different. So instead of it being this series of wires and the physical connection is what indicates where there's a touch, capacitive creates an electric field. When your finger encounters that electric field, really any capacitive or conductive surface, I should say, not capacitive, but a conductive surface, it alters that electric field. And sensors inside the device can detect where that point of contact is based upon the change of the electric field itself. Now, this is why if you use gloves that don't have a conductive surface on them, so they don't have like conductive thread woven into them or anything, it's very difficult to get a capacitive touchscreen to work because you don't have a conductive surface interfering with that electric field. Generally speaking, gloves don't tend to be conductive unless, again, you have that conductive thread woven into them. It's also why I remember a story from several years ago that people, I want to say it was in Japan, were starting to use hot dogs as a stylus for their smartphones when it would get cold. So they would have gloves and use a hot dog, which would be conductive. They would use that to make selections and commands on their phones. So with the resistive approach, it's all dependent upon pressure. You have to press, and if you're not pressing hard enough to make the contact with those wires, then it won't be registered. With capacitive, it's not dependent upon pressure. You don't need to push harder to make a stronger electric field, although it may, by pressing harder, indicate a larger surface area coming into contact with the screen, which, you know, you could design a program that would react differently depending upon how much pressure was applied simply by measuring how much surface area is being affected. The problem with the resilience that I was talking about earlier is that at least with earlier resistive touchpads, the more you would move around, the more you would use it, the more it would start to wear down. And over time, your touchpad would become less responsive because it was starting to just wear away from use. Whereas capacitive ones, you know, you don't have to have this hard contact to make sure that it's registering a touch, and they could last longer. For a while, capacitive touchpads were much more expensive than resistive. So resistive were very popular, particularly in industrial uses where you might have like a tablet that has a resistive screen and it's meant for heavy duty use. There's no point in making it delicate because it was going to be in a tough environment anyway. And resistive was really popular. These days, the difference in price is not as great. So we mostly see capacitive screens, particularly in things like smartphones and tablets. So I hope that answers that question. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. on the network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Take your work on the road, and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Let's move on to the next email. This one comes from Greg and says, "Hey, Jonathan, I enjoy your show, Tech Stuff, and Forward Thinking a lot. Y'all are some real gangstas." Thanks. Don't really think of myself as gangsta. That's a new one for me. So you did an episode on TV connectors recently and mentioned impedance, gain, and attenuation, and then said that could be its own podcast. So I'd love to hear a podcast about those topics. Maybe also explain decibels as well. All right, Greg, here goes. This is going to be an attempt on my part to explain these concepts. First of all, I got to come clean because, you know, have you ever had that experience where you encounter a word and you have to say the word out loud? And then you realize as you're about to say the word out loud that you've never really heard that word spoken before, or if you had, you hadn't really paid attention. And so you just have to give a wild guess as to how it's pronounced. And then you guess wrong, because that is exactly what happened to me the last time I talked about impedance. I believe I pronounced it impedance, which, while hilarious, is not correct. So if any of my listeners out there tried to follow my lead and found themselves in socially awkward situations because of their pronunciation, I humbly apologize. But no, that was definitely one of those cases where in my brain, I'm like, oh, it has to be spelled like, or pronounced like this because of the way it's spelled. And I was absolutely wrong. And in fact, if I had thought about it for a second, I would have realized how wrong I was, because it's about impeding. It's impedance because it impedes the flow of electricity. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So when we talk about impedance, we need to first talk about voltage. And for those of you who have taken physics and you know all about circuitry and voltage and current and resistance, I apologize, but in order to explain impedance, I kind of have to lay some groundwork. So just stick with me here. Voltage is the difference in electrical energy charge of electrical potential energy between two points. And that sounds weird, but another way to look at it is that voltage is how we describe an electric field. We measure electric fields in volts over a distance. So you have to have a difference in voltage in order for current to flow. Another way of thinking that is you need to have an excess of electrons on one side of your circuit and a place for electrons to go on the other side of your circuit. And that is a difference in voltage. You have a positive charge on one side and a negative charge on the other. And that allows the electrons to move from negative to positive. We won't go into the difference between the flow of electrons and the flow of current here. I know I've talked about that in previous episodes of Tech Stuff, and it's not really relevant in this case. You just need to know that voltage is this difference in electric charge and electric potential energy between two points across some distance. When you apply voltage to a circuit, that's when you induce electricity to flow through that circuit. Now, the circuit is made of some sort of conductive material. Now, conductive material doesn't allow electricity to flow through effortlessly. There's an opposition to the flow of electricity, and it's called resistance. And resistance depends upon a couple different factors. Several, actually. It depends upon the material. It depends upon how much of the material is there. In other words, if you have a very small copper wire, that actually has a much higher resistance than, say, very thick copper cable. It also depends upon temperature. Supercooling semiconductors can reduce the resistance to near zero, or effectively zero. And you get, free and clear electricity flowing through without any resistance. And, you know, otherwise what happens is the opposition to that electrical flow will end up having you, the component will actually start to generate heat. And this is where we talk about how efficient an electronic device is. If it's generating a lot of heat, you're losing a lot of energy to heat. That the electricity is being converted into heat energy and not doing whatever it was you were hoping for it to do. Unless, of course, it was a heating component, in which case it's doing exactly what you wanted it to do. So that's resistance. Now, in direct current circuits, resistance suffices as the term we use for this phenomenon. But with alternating current, AC applications, these are different because the current alternates. It flows in one direction, the circuit, and then flows in the opposite direction. And it does this in cycles, different frequencies. Well, usually it's in a single frequency, but the frequencies can vary depending upon the technology we're talking about. So in this case, we don't use the term resistance. We actually use a different term, and that is impedance, because impedance relies on two factors, not just the magnitude, which is pretty much what resistance is concerned with, but the phase of the system as well. So impedance impedes the flow of electricity, but it consists of reactance as well as resistance. And reactance is the extent to which a circuit stores and releases energy as the current and voltage fluctuate with each alternating current cycle. So we describe reactance in terms of ohms, and it really only applies to AC circuits. Reactance allows us to use circuit components such as capacitors and inductors. Capacitors store energy in an electric field, and inductors store energy in a magnetic field, and both can operate as resistors, and they don't generate heat the same way that resistors do. So they're very useful in AC circuitry. So that's impedance. It's an important factor whenever you're designing any kind of electronic component that's working on AC. Next, we have gain, which is the next thing that Greg asked us about. This is also known as the amplification factor, and it gives you some clue as to what's going on with gain. It's all about amplifying a signal to boost its strength from input to output. So you've got an incoming signal. Then you use a means of amplification to increase the strength of that signal. So it's the same frequency, but greater amplitude. And then you put it through the output. This is used in all sorts of applications. The easiest one to imagine happens to be sound, where a microphone will convert acoustic waves into electrical impulses that then will go to an amplifier before going to a speaker in order to strengthen the signals so that you can get an audible acoustic wave on the other end once you get through the stereo. But amplifiers are used for all sorts of technology, not just acoustic technology. At any rate, we express gain in terms of decibels, and this is where things get a little confusing for people, often because I think a lot of people are familiar with decibels as a means of measuring the volume of sound, but it's not just the volume of sound, it's the strength of signals. And a decibel is a logarithmic unit, which makes it a little tricky to understand, particularly if you're mostly familiar with them in terms of that sound magnitude. Gain's more about, in electronics anyway, it's about electric signal strength, not about sound volume. And decibels are really a way of describing two different levels of signal strength. You know, instead of just saying this one's stronger than that one, it's a way of giving a unit to it and saying, this is how much stronger the signal is going out than it was coming in. You know, we were talking about amplifying. So that incoming signal is at a certain strength. How do you describe the outgoing strength compared to the incoming strength? Let's talk about sound first, though. So when we're considering sound, near total silence is 0 decibels, and it acts as our starting point. So this isn't completely silent. It's not like what you would experience if you were somehow able to live out in space where there's no sound. It's essentially the strength of the smallest audible sound. Now, a sound that's 10 times louder than that, than 0 decibels, would be at 10 decibels. But a sound 100 times more powerful than 0 isn't 100 decibels, it's 20 decibels. And a sound 1,000 times stronger than 0 decibels isn't 1,000 dB or decibels, it's 30 decibels. Now, normal conversation is in the range of 60 decibels. A car horn is around 110 decibels. A jet engine is around 120 decibels. A gunshot right at the source is about 140 decibels. So in this case, we're talking about the difference in intensity on a logarithmic scale from being practically silent. Now, amplification factors are a little different because you can actually have negative decibels. In sound, that doesn't make any sense. It's not like you can be quieter than silent or get somehow more quiet than no noise at all. That's not what negative decibels means. Instead, what it means is that you have an incoming signal, and then you step down the power of that signal before you put it through output. So you can have negative decibels. The incoming signal is stronger than the outgoing signal is. This is also really important for sound engineers as well. So that is an amplification. That is attenuation, but more on that in a second. So with gain, we're talking about boosting signal power and not stepping it down. Gain can boost a signal's power a few decibels to around 30 decibels in strength, depending upon the application. You can also cascade amplification to boost it further, but there is a problem in that amplification can introduce noise into the signal. And each time you amplify that signal again, it's going to also amplify the noise. So you can't continuously amplify a signal. Eventually, you're going to have so much noise that there won't be any signal anymore. It ends up creating distortion. So you have a limitation, a practical limitation on how much you can amplify a signal. Attenuation, going back to that, is the reduction of a signal strength. So this can be any signal. It doesn't have to be an electric signal. Sunglasses attenuate the light that comes from the sun that hits your eyeballs, for example. This is also called loss, often in the engineering, electrical engineering biz. And signals attenuate over distance. It's just something that happens. So radio waves will attenuate over a distance. Light will attenuate over distance across things like fiber optic cables. Electricity will attenuate over great distances. And it's one of those problems that engineers had to get around using various means. One of the big ones being repeaters. So let's say you've got a cable and you've got a signal going through the cable. It's going to attenuate as it travels down this cable. You may have to have a repeater that would take in the incoming signal and generate a new one to continue down the line to keep on going toward its destination. And you might have multiple repeaters across an entire network in order to get signals to go from point A to point B. So, attenuation is just a fact of physics. You know, you can't engineer your way around it entirely. You can find better and better ways of preserving signals so that they attenuate more slowly. And in fact, if you look at the attenuation in cables, the less attenuation per distance you have, the more efficient that cable is. There's some cable manufacturers that really rely on this as a way of saying, hey, our cables are way better than our competitors because we have very little loss. We have engineered our cables so that they are superior. In most cases, at least for consumers, I would argue that the difference is negligible. The signal loss is so small and the error correction in most electronics is so good that it would be difficult to notice as a consumer, if not impossible to notice. However, depending upon what you're using it for, if it's something super high end and you're having to have truly very long cables, attenuation can be a problem. This is particularly an issue with like quantum computing. In fact, with quantum computing right now, we expect that there is a hard limit to how far away you could have nodes be from one another in order to communicate effectively. I believe, I don't have this figure in front of me, but I believe that the theoretical upper limit is somewhere around 500 kilometers. And beyond that, you would not be able to have a quantum computer network be able to communicate with, node to node. So that's an issue. It's one of the limiting factors. It may be that that means we'll have quantum computing networks, but never a quantum internet, not a true one anyway. That's a possibility. Anyway, I hope that ends up explaining the concepts of impedance, gain, and attenuation. It's pretty interesting stuff, and I feel like I could go on a lot more about that, probably bring in a couple of engineers and really talk about it, but I hope that serves as a good introduction into the concepts. Let's take another quick break to thank our sponsor. You know, mailing and shipping can really be a big pain. If you go to the post office, you have to stand in line. And if you don't go to the post office, then your only other choice seems to be a postage meter, which is really expensive. But in fact, there is another way, a better way, stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official United States postage for any letter or package using your own computer and your own printer. And I've used this. I've used there's a scale you can get, and it's fantastic. It plugs in via USB to your laptop. It makes it figuring out postage incredibly simple. You just send it to the printer. You're ready to go. Incredibly useful if you have a Kickstarter campaign and you're going to be mailing out a lot of rewards, you have a small business, I can't recommend it highly enough. And in fact, right now, use the promo code TechStuff for this special offer. There is a no-risk trial and you will get $110 in bonuses. That includes $55 free postage. Go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TechStuff. That's stamps.com and enter TechStuff. All right. right, our next piece of listener mail comes from listener Keegan McDougall, who had a really cool question. And Keegan was asking about a philosophical question, an ethical question that is called the trolley problem, and wanted to know how it relates to autonomous cars. And I thought, well, this is a point where I could kind of give my own answer, and that would be fine, but I think it would really benefit from an actual discussion, which is why I have invited my super secret guest star, whom I alluded to earlier in the show. And it turns out to be Ben Bolin of Car Stuff and Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. I think both of those shows relate to the topic we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me on. And I got to say, I love the listener mail episodes. So this is a really great question that Keegan has asked.
Yeah. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
Came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
I think first, obviously, we should probably talk about what the trolley problem is, what the trolley question mm-hmm. is. And this is really kind of a cognitive science slash ethical slash moral quandary kind mm-hmm. of question. Mm-hmm. And it's a hypothetical situation, thankfully, not a practical exam.
So far as we know.
So the hypothetical question, the most basic version of this is that there is a track and a trolley is out of control running down this track. And there is a person on the track. And if the trolley, or actually there's five people on the track. And if the trolley continues, it will collide with and presumably kill all five of these people.
Mm-hmm.
You are next to a switch that will switch the track to a separate, run of track. And there's one person on that separate one. So if you pull the switch, you will save the five people from certain death. But you will condemn the person who's on the separate track to death.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, do you pull the lever or not? Do you actually make that move? And it's not like there's a right or wrong answer to this. There are answers that more people are, will frequently give. And most people would say that to sacrifice one person to save five people makes the most sense.
Right. We're doing the Vulcan response.
Right. Right. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one.
Right.
Also known as the utilitarian response, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very common way of looking at it. And then there are variations on this question. Like, what if instead of pulling a lever, you are on the trolley? And the trolley is out of control and it's heading toward five people on the track, and you can stop the trolley if you push a fat person who's on the trolley with you out in front. The trolley will hit the fat person and come to a stop before hitting anyone else. That means you actively have to kill a person. It's not so much you pull a switch and someone else dies instead of five people. You are actively killing them. And now we start seeing people say, I don't know that I could do that.
Right.
Like, taking no action and allowing people to die feels differently than taking an active role and killing someone to prevent five other people from dying.
Yeah. And other people would argue, well, you're still committing a murder by pulling the switch. It's
right.
Just a more comfortable thing, sort of similar to buying prepared food versus going into the forest and killing your own thing.
Right. Or if you want to think of it in a kind of a military way, it could be the general calling for the order of the big push, as opposed to someone who's actually on the front lines who would make that same call.
Yeah, that's a really good point, which that actually comes up in a lot of war crime trials.
Oh, yeah. Too. I mean, yeah. If you look at the history of World War I, that was the history of World War I, right? There were lots of criticisms leveled against generals who seemed far too eager to commit huge numbers of soldiers to potential death and destruction for what were often seen as arbitrary gains.
Sure.
But getting back to the trolley problem and the question Keegan had, the reason this relates back to autonomous cars is you could imagine scenarios in which an autonomous car would have to make a split decision, and how do you program in that decision? So here's an example I would give.
Okay.
Let's say that you are in your autonomous car. The car is driving for you. You are not in control.
Mm-hmm.
The car is going down a street and there are pedestrians all along the sidewalk to your right. All right?
All right.
An oncoming car under manual control loses control. So the driver loses control of that vehicle and it begins to swerve into your lane. Your car is unable to move off to the left because of the trajectory of the incoming car.
Mm-hmm.
So what does your car do? Your car, having traffic behind you, can't back up. So your options are essentially to hit the brakes and you're going to have a collision with an oncoming car, which could potentially put you, the passenger, at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Or the car could swerve to the right, avoid a collision, but potentially collide with pedestrians.
Mm-hmm.
In either case, you're talking about people potentially being hurt or killed. How do you, as a programmer who's designing the autonomous car, make that call? And is it right for an engineer to make that call, knowing that the person who is inside the car might have had a different reaction?
Yeah, these are great questions, and they tie into some topical things that are going to become an increasingly big issue for car owners and car manufacturers. As abstract and philosophical as this might sound in some degree, this is a real life problem. So a brief explanation here. One of the things that we should mention when we get to real world applications is if there is a real person driving a trolley, unfortunately, we do have to allow for their preformed opinions of the kind of people they're saving to come into play.
Sure.
So five people that they consider unsavory, or, you know, five elderly people versus one child.
Right. Usually the way we present this problem is that you have no information about the potential mm-hmm. victims, because otherwise, I mean, there are variations. Like, sure. there's one where you're on the trolley. There are five people on the tracks, and the person who's responsible for the trolley being out of control is also on the trolley. You can push that person out.
Right.
And yeah. most people would say yes, because this person has committed the act that has put everyone in danger in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it is ethically all right to have that person be held responsible by way of killing them to prevent the deaths of their otherwise potential victims.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's correct for at least the hypothetical nature of it to keep the emphasis on the problem, which is the problematic decision, the
right.
dilemma. But when we talk about programming what could potentially be a death machine.
Sure.
You know, what we find quickly is that we might run into problems of profiling through code. Could we teach a computer that level of fidelity, and could we teach it to be something that people agree with directly? Furthermore, I've got to say, man, I was thinking about this since we were talking about it briefly off air. One of the first answers that a lot of people go to with an AI problem is, well, the three laws of robotics
right.
are perfect, but they don't work in this occasion because they're asking the robot, quote unquote, to differentiate between values of human life, which the first law doesn't allow for.
Right. It's a no-win scenario mm-hmm. for the robot, right? Because yeah. no matter what choice is made, there's going to be some form of injury as a result. So there's no way that the robot can make a decision that is going to result in no one getting hurt. That's just not even an option. You've got the traffic behind you, so you can't magically say, oh, well, just plop it into reverse.
Right.
So that way you avoid the collision. And you can't say, oh, well, find a gap in the people. Like, there are going to be situations where this hypothetical question can and will arise. Now, you could argue that when we get closer and closer to more autonomous cars being on the road, the likelihood of the situation decreases dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if you have vehicles that are capable of communicating with one another, because then they're going to know each other's positions well before you're in range of each other.
Yeah, for sure.
Then you just have to worry about the things that are not part of the system, like pedestrians crossing the street, mm-hmm. jaywalkers, dogs,
yeah.
you know, that sort of stuff. Which could still be a factor. Also, we keep in mind that the autonomous cars are able to react in a fraction of the time that humans are.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And they're able to detect everything that's going on. See, we humans, we're limited by what we can focus on at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
So even our field of view is a limitation, right?
Yeah.
So a car doesn't have that. A car can have a 360-degree area of awareness and a fraction of the amount of time it takes a human to react to be able to make these decisions. That being said, you still have this problem of there are scenarios that are possible where ultimately someone has to figure out, how do they program this in? Do they build it in to the car's programming where if it detects pedestrians, mm-hmm. those have the top priority of safety because they are the ones who are least likely to be able to survive an impact.
Yeah.
And therefore, you'd never want to have a crash, but if the choice is between crash or plowing into pedestrians, you'd pick the crash. That's what I would suspect,
mm-hmm.
because I would imagine also that anyone making these cars would test to make sure that they withstood the same crash test parameters that other vehicles do. So in that case, I would say that the autonomous car is more likely to be designed, and I think this from a manufacturer's point of view too,
okay.
to withstand the crash. That not that that's necessarily always going to be the quote unquote right choice from an ethics point of view,
uh-huh.
but if I'm a car manufacturer, I definitely would rather have the message be, in this very unlikely scenario, the car would prepare for impact, essentially, rather than run amok on the sidewalk.
Exactly. And that's the primary concern. As cold as it may sound, the truth of the matter is that if you are a car manufacturer, part of what you're selling to car buyers is a sense of safety. So I think that the priorities would be a little bit different. The number one priority would probably be the passengers within the vehicle, mm-hmm. to the point that with this preparation for impact, which I love what you're saying, then it may be a case where the car simply stops, proactively deploys its airbags, and perhaps, I don't know, maybe has some brake system that braces for impact.
It might even orient itself so that the crumple zones are at the best angle for preparing for an impact, which, you know, sounds kind of crazy. You're thinking, oh, it's a car that would actually maneuver itself so it would suffer more damage. But it may be that that's the ideal way to deal with this kind of situation, to make sure that everyone involved has the best chance of suffering the least amount of injury.
Yes, and this brings us to something that we probably don't have time for today, but is an interesting question. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too, Keegan. If we have that kind of programming, which is really, really the definition of live fire, just the inherent danger here.
Sure.
Then what happens when people modify that programming? Because, I mean, you know this, Jonathan, there's this increasingly big stink over the computerization of cars and the degree of control over that programming still held by manufacturers.
Oh, sure.
And people are buying cars and saying, why can't I work on my car?
Right. And then there's the hacker community that have said that they would be able to get control of various car systems. And that's been demonstrated in the past. Now, until very recently, it's all been limited to people who are able to hook a laptop directly into the wiring of a vehicle. So it meant that you had to have physical access to the car in order to have that happen. However, that being said, I know there's a conference coming up this summer in which a pair of presenters are going to say that they have found a way of remotely accessing a vehicle and hacking it. I'm very curious to hear how they did that. I imagine the only way I could imagine it working is you would obviously have to have some sort of transceiver on the car that could communicate out and receive communication back. And typically, I would imagine that would be limited to a car's entertainment system. Mm-hmm. But if that entertainment system is also hooked into the other various computer systems on a car, then that is a potential point of vulnerability. Now, if you've designed a car where it can wirelessly communicate with a mechanic to allow a mechanic to get more information about the vehicle and its current state, then that would also be a potential point of vulnerability. I just don't imagine that happening because I don't think the convenience of that particular system would warrant the investment in it, because it's not that much more difficult for a mechanic to just hook their computer up to your car's computer system. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's so hard to do that, you know, we needed to find an alternative to that.
Right.
But that being said, knowing that this is a possibility, that the ability to hack into a car could become a thing, and knowing that autonomous cars are, they're a growing reality. Mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, the roboticist Henrik Christensen said the kids born today will never have to drive a car because the cars that they'll have when they reach driving age will all be autonomous. Mm-hmm. I think that's fairly accurate. I mean, some people say it won't be till 2040. I don't think that's true. I think that we're much closer to seeing it become a commercial possibility within a decade.
Sure.
All of that is to say that because of that reality of the autonomous cars, something like the possibility of hacking is certainly a concern. If you are a hacker who owns your own car and you wanted to remove things like the cap on speed limits,
sure,
so that your car could drive much faster, even if you're not the one physically controlling it, you just enjoy the experience of riding in a really fast car, that's a concern. If you are able to do things like for whatever reason, remove the safety features that would prevent your car from braking too late or accelerating too early.
Or position itself correctly for a crash because you don't want to lose a big investment.
Yeah, any of those things would be, you know, a concern. So, these are questions that we don't have real answers to yet because we're not technologically there yet. But they are definitely questions that need to be thought of on the engineering and manufacture side of things because these are things that are going to come up. And, you know, you might argue, well, this is a, you know, it's a niche thing. It's only going to happen like a few times, but potentially that could be devastating if you don't actually address it.
Yeah. And also, you know, it's a tough spot for car makers because as reasonable as it is for you and I, and probably a lot of you guys listening out there too, as reasonable as it is for all of us as individuals to say, well, the utilitarian answer is correct. Spock is correct.
Right.
If GM or someone came out and said, well, guys, autonomous cars are still in the early days, so here's what we're going to do if someone has to die.
If this situation comes up, it's going to make sure it only kills one person instead of five. Then immediately you've got everyone say, all right, we have it on record that this car company has said it's okay to kill people.
Right.
So when it happens, we can totally go and say, no, you have it on record that this is what you've decided to do. Yeah. No, it's definitely, again, that's why I would think that car manufacturers would try to limit the liability they would be under.
Yeah.
And say like, well, you know, maybe it ends up being common practice that when you buy a car that has an autonomous control feature on it, that you also end up signing waivers that waive your legal rights to go after a company should one of these crazy scenarios come along. I don't know if that would actually hold water because I would say, imagine there'd be a lot of pushback on that saying, well, how can you hold a customer culpable when they have literally no control over the vehicle?
Right. Yeah,
they didn't build the vehicle. They didn't design the software. They didn't decide how it navigates. They just told it a destination. How can you hold them responsible for that just because they own the machine? They didn't make it do the thing it did. These are great questions. I love thinking about it. I wish I had more answers, but honestly, it's one of those deals that I think is going to shake out as the technology matures. And, you know, in a best case scenario, they'll largely be moot questions because the implementation of the technology will be sophisticated enough where these problems will rarely, if ever, pop up. That's a dream.
That's very optimistic.
But I you know, shoot for the stars, dude.
Right.
I want my self-driving car. I want to make that clear. I am not against the idea of autonomous cars. I eagerly await the day when I can have an autonomous car take me to work.
You've earned it.
Yeah, well, it sure would be nice to get here in 12 minutes instead of an hour, you know? And I don't drive, so for me, I would need an autonomous car because I'm not a driver.
You know, Scott's not into it.
I know. I've had him on the show a couple times to talk about. In fact, we had a discussion about hacking cars, and we also did a discussion about autonomous cars. And I could see, you know, every time I started talking about autonomous cars, he'd start to squirm in his seat a little. And,
just a little.
You know, so not all of us are, like, you know, race car drivers in our heads with lead feet and lightning-like reflexes. Some of us just want to get to where we need to go and not have to deal with the navigating through traffic on our own. I mean, I've seen what it does to sane people. I cannot take that, Ben. It would not work.
Luckily, it looks like everything that we have seen tells us that there is a rise in autonomous vehicles, and they are at some point, wherever you are listening right now, they are at some point coming to your town.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of them may be driving around right now, depending on where you're at.
Oh, yeah.
I got to see a few when I went out to San Francisco. It was pretty cool. All right. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining me for that segment. And I'm sure Keegan appreciates it too.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys.
And remember, you can check out Ben's shows. He's on Car Stuff. He's on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. He's also a writer and appears for shows like Brain Stuff and What the Stuff. If you guys are big into video, you should definitely check those out. You should check out the other podcasts as well. And of course, it's always a pleasure having you on, and I will be asking you to be a guest probably again really soon.
Hey, thank you. Just to point out to everybody, Jonathan, in full disclosure, you're on like half of those shows as well.
That's true. I also appear on those shows. So, yeah, if you haven't seen What the Stuff, like, go ahead and give a quick description. So What the Stuff is kind of a show where we pick interesting topics and give really cool examples of whatever that topic happens to be. So, I've got one coming up about oddest sports in the world, and I talk about some really crazy ones. And then Brain Stuff is kind of a dive into really cool questions about how stuff works or interesting science questions, that kind of thing. And those are always a lot of fun to do too.
Yeah. You've got, you guys know Jonathan's a little bit of an actor in a different life, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Can I say that on the air?
Absolutely.
And, did this great piece on Brain Stuff, about why people in old movies.
The transatlantic accent.
Yeah. I think we made the title, Why Do People Talk Funny in Old Movies?
Yeah, I think that is what the title was. That ended up being a really popular one.
Yeah, that was a great one.
It was a lot of fun.
Check
to
that
do.
Out if you want to see some of the guys' chops.
Right. And obviously we've got tons of other shows here at How Stuff Works, not to mention crazy, amazing articles. I don't know how many of you have been to the howstuffworks.com website. But you should definitely check it out. Check out, we're going to have some great things to announce in the near future. Mm-hmm. Really excited. I mean, it's always been a great place to work, but it's really becoming like crazy exciting over the last year. So check that out, guys. I know that I haven't really talked about the website in a long time, but you definitely need to check that out. All right. That wraps up this discussion. If you guys have any questions, if you want to have your listener mail be part of the next grab bag, I want to do a lot more of these in the future. It's always fun to kind of respond to what you guys have to say and think. Send me a message. That email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. Or drop me a line on Twitter, Facebook, or Tumblr. At all three, I use the handle TechStuff, HSW. And we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
From BBC Radio 4. Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.